Pray now. Lord, we thank you so much for that interruption. We thank you so much for our beloved Annette, who tomorrow will have been gone for 1 year. And I've noticed that she's been very, very present with us all through the preparations for this beautiful event. She's here, she's with us. And I also wanted to thank the heavens for bringing the voice of the feminine into the world over the last 10 years. And despite the discomfort of race, colour, creed, gender, there are voices for Christ lifting us all up to higher ground. They are really, really filled with Christ. We pray for the people in Ukraine. We pray for the people in Russia. Neither party really wanted to go to war. And nobody wins in war. And now, as we move to doing the reading, we're going to ask for prayers for John Rawson, John the Mystic, and the priest. And with his incredible abilities, he's going to be describing what has happened and what we can do over the next year. And I'm always forever grateful for his presence in our lives. So tonight I ask that he is taken care of and he is guarded by your angels, and that he shall be forever in our hearts. So shall it be.
So shall it be. Stand in darkness. Night has fallen. Light has not come yet. Around me I feel the presence of beings, the presence of many other souls. And very softly at first, but then more distinctly, I hear them beginning to sing. And it's an old, sounds to me like an old Slavic hymn. And I'm going to sing it as best I can. I'm going to sing the melody so that we have it on record. As the sound grows around me, I become aware that each of these souls, these perhaps thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of souls, holding candles, each holding their own candle with its own tiny light, and they press around me. They are trying to move forward, but they are imprisoned, as I am, in this darkness. And I'll try and translate some of the words that I hear. They are singing something like this. Weep. Yeah, very real. Weep, for the day is ending. Weep, for the light is done. Weep. For your wives and daughters, weep for your sons. And these are the souls that have been sent violently, suddenly, into death, into the spiritual worlds, because of the conflicts within Ukraine, between Ukraine and Russia. And they have been unable to move on, unable to progress, because they are held. Russians, Ukrainians, it makes no difference. They are all held, immobile, through the grief, through the rage, through the anger, through the despair of the peoples of that region. Whether they're victors, whether they're defeated, it makes no difference to these souls. It makes a difference to them that they are now in darkness, and only alleviate the darkness by this one tiny light of the candle. And each candle illuminates just the one soul. The lights don't join, they're all individual. They're like a host of fireflies in the dark. And I'm aware of another presence, a greater spirit, a greater being. It's a female presence. She has her back to me. And as I perceive her, she stands before two huge doors made of brass, and she grasps the handles and she throws the doors open, and brilliant light streams in. It illuminates us where we stand, and all the souls with their tiny little candles I see as being clad in grey robes, like monks of old. And they are all, like me, gazing into the light, which comes from some source that is not the sun, but lies beyond the sun. And the lady turns and she sings. She sings back to all the souls, and her words are about the coming of the light. The fact that even though night may bring its legacy, the borders of night may enfold us, yet every night has an ending, and this night too will end in day. And as they move into the light, I see the souls, the forms of the souls, dissolving around me like a light grey mist. And the lady leads me onwards down the path towards the light. And as we move further down the path, we see that we have arrived in a huge hall, something like a huge library. There are thousands, tens of thousands, perhaps more books stacked within the shelves around the walls as far as I can see, as high as I can see. And the lady goes to one of the shelves and she pulls out a very old book. Its cover is black. It's quite tattered. It's been well used. And she presents me with the book. And she says, "John, this is the new energy entering into the year, which is also a very old year, a very old energy. For this will be the year of revelation." And with that, I'm allowed to open the book, and it is indeed the book of Revelation. The Biblio Apocalyptus is written across the title page. The book of the unveiling. And we leave the library and I've entered into another room where there are people either both in the body and out of the body, sitting in a sort of a seats arranged in sort of a semicircle around a podium, something like a podium or a lectern at the front. And the there are seven or eight rows of people, and there's an aisle going down the centre. And I'm led to one of the seats in one of the semicircular rows. And as I sit down, the stage is lit up, if you like, by the presence of a being whose face shines like the sun, as the old sayings have it. And he tells us, he says, "This will be the year of revelation." The revelations that will come to each soul are for each individually, and each and all of us together. That for over 2,000 years, certain truths have been hidden from view, certain understandings have been hidden. And now the colleges of light will release them into human consciousness. And for most, they will remain unconscious. Those of you who've been given the Book of Revelation have been given the task of unpacking, of decrypting, that's my word, not his, but it's got a sense of looking deeply into something and understanding its meaning and its structure at a very deep level. And for a moment I'm suspended in space. The moment I'm in spirit, and I hear a voice that says, it doesn't say right what the Spirit says to the churches, by the way, it says something quite different. It says, "Watch and understand." And I'm presented with a series of pictures, a series of images. And some of these we can carry in our consciousness this year because they carry within them energies which, if we meditate on them, if we hold them in our consciousness, will unlock abilities, talents, and insights of our own. And first of all, I'm shown a galaxy. It's a spiral galaxy, suspended in the midst of the universe, rotating very, very slowly. And then I'm shown at the other end of the spectrum, so to speak, the DNA within the genome, within the genes of every living being, and that also is a spiral. And the voice says, the spiral is the creative form, the creative energy of the universe. If you understand the energy and the meaning of the spiral, you will understand your own creative potential, your own ability to move from the edge to the source, and to take from the source and give to the edges, give to the boundaries, because the spiral is one. And finally, I'm shown a third spiral, and it's a series of patterns, spiral patterns, in an open sunflower. And I can't quite explain it. I'm told that our universe is based on numbers, and that one of the simplest number systems starts when you take one and you add one, which makes two. You add one to two and you get three. You add two to three and you get five. You add three to five and you get eight. You add five to eight and you get 13. You add eight to 13 and you get 21. And so it goes. And when you take these numbers, these foundations of the universe, they create a spiral. So creation is developed from within the spiral. And we carry the pattern of the spiral within our own spiritual being, within the awakening and the evolution of the spiritual centers that start at the heart and radiate outwards until the most extreme centers, the crown center and the base center, are lit up with the force of creation. And the voice says, when you understand the mystery of sex and the mystery of God, then you will become both. You will become God as a sexual being, God as a lover, God as male and God as female, one and the same. And that's why there is no Christ without Mary, and there's no purpose of Mary without Christ. That within ourselves we have to unite the male and the female. I'm shown a second picture, and this picture is one I've read of, and at the center of the picture, of the scene, is a being seated on a throne, and his face is filled with lightning, and lightning flashes around him. The colours of the rainbow flash around him, and on the four corners of where he's seated, there are four living beings: an eagle, an ox, a lion, and a being in human form holding a water jar. And these are the forces of the four elements which work within the human psyche. And then surrounding the throne is something that Revelation calls a sea of glass. And I understand why it's a sea of glass. It's as though the ocean has been frozen for a moment. And the ocean is the astral. And the picture when it is unfolded, when it is understood, is an explanation of how we unfold and evolve as spiritual beings. And then there are, of course, on the outside of the picture, surrounding the throne and the four living beings and the sea of glass, there are 24 elders. And they are all saying, "Holy, holy, holy, Lord God of hosts, heaven and earth are full of your glory. Glory be to you, O Lord Most High." And that's not just a saying. Every time they, every time the 24 elders cry out in praise, then a subtle change happens within the human being, because this, the being of light, crowned in the midst on a throne in the midst of the sea of glass and the four living beings and the 24 elders, is a representation. The being in the centre is the real self, the Christ self, the I am, the Buddha nature, whatever you would like to call it, the Atma, the eternal being within the reality of who we are. And the four living beings, as I've said, they are the elements with which we have to work. The 24 elders represent, because they come in pairs, there are 12 pairs of two, they represent that when one treads the spiritual path, when one starts to awaken on the spiritual path, then changes happen in the physical body, and they are mediated through the 12 pairs of cranial nerve systems. And we should not separate spiritual work from physical work. They are connected. And many people make the mistake of thinking that they can just waltz through a spiritual life, don't have to work, and it will be given to them. And that we can just relax because Christ has died, saved us from sin, etc., etc., etc. Or the Buddha will swoop down as a bodhisattva and sweep us all up into the Nirmanakaya. We have many reasons for deflecting the work. But spirituality, like music, demands excellence. One doesn't fiddle. One doesn't toy with spirituality. Because playing with spirit is worse than ignoring it or shutting it out. Because once one sets one's feet on the spiritual path, gateways, doorways are open. So the year of revelation, the revelation is that creation is within us. That's the first revelation. The second revelation is that we hold our own salvation in our hands, and it's up to us to bloody well put in the work, because God's not going to do it for us. If we can't be bothered to set a few minutes aside every day for spiritual practice, spiritual contemplation, a little bit of meditation, or even just observing how we get upset with other people, how we make judgments, all of this comes under the heading of cultivating our spiritual I am-ness. If we can't do that, we will stop moving forwards in evolution. And I presume that you're all here tonight because in some form or another you have committed to spiritual cultivation, whether that's walking the way of the wise art, whether it's having a daily prayer, whether it's doing the rosary, we do not mind. Every day, become aware of self as a spiritual being. And then you will find that power moves through the nerve centres in the spine, which has got so many names, and moves upwards gently into the head. And then, like a flower, the crown centre opens and it sheds something like dew throughout the whole of the physical and etheric bodies. And this is what the Chinese would call the qi, that we start from the base with this, with our sexuality, we raise it to the highest that we can conceive, the ultimate, and our body will respond by producing something that feels like a shower, a very gentle shower of rain or of dew. That is the second revelation. The third revelation. I have two images competing, so to speak, but the first I think I'll take is the book with seven seals. And the book I hold, which is the book of Revelation, it's locked in seven places in the way I have it, and it has to be unlocked in a particular order, and each seal, if you like, each lock releases different energies into our spiritual bodies, into the spiritual centres. And I can't say any more here, that has to be passed on as it's revealed later in the year, because revelation, this is not instant enlightenment, guys, this is revelation, and one receives something, but it is meaningless unless we work at it. And I'm told that I have to work with the is being unlocked through the seven seals, and if I get an opportunity to transmit it to those who need to know. And the fourth image that is given to me is a woman. And this is a woman who is clothed with, well, Revelation calls it a woman clothed with the sun. But as what that, what I see is that it's a woman whose nudity, whose nakedness is clothed in this amazing radiant light. And she stands upon a moon with its horns up. And she is crowned with stars. And she holds in her hands the book. The glowing light is the etheric. And there is a huge significance for us at this time in this image. The woman is pregnant. The woman is the soul. She's pregnant with the individuality, the Christ self. She's Mary going to bring Christ into the world. We all will bring, are bringing Christ into the world because Christ dwells within us. And the voice says, humanity is entering the shadows at the in the present time. From the beginning, the end of the 19th century, and the beginning of the Christ the 20th century, the powers of Christ sent certain energies into the world, spiritual energies, and they would manifest in particular ways. And what was going to be manifested was the at the end of the very end of the 19th century, the guardianship of the era changed from the Archangel Samael to the Archangel Michael. And what Michael needed to do was establish a school for souls, because for 2,000 years the spiritual worlds had been closed to souls. They had become like brass, and we could no longer at will enter into spirit. So Michael's work was to establish a school. First of all, the school was in spirit, and many of us spent time in the Michael school between incarnations. But Michael needed the school to be established within the physical world as well. And his first attempt was through Rudolf Steiner and the movement that he founded that we know as Anthroposophy. And Steiner was the forebearer, the forerunner of the existence of the Michael School in a physical form, through physical beings. So what Rudolf Steiner did was bring the teachings of Michael into human consciousness, because he was an initiate from the Michael School. And the first, the Michael School is going to be inculcated in two stages, and the first stage is what one might call the Aristotelian stream, through Aristotle. Now Aristotle, God bless Aristotle, he was very knowledgeable, very insightful, he was very intellectual, and he didn't like being told what to do or being contradicted. He was very opinionated, and God bless us, Aristotle came to Earth in the form of Rudolf Steiner in the first part of the 20th century. And Aristotle had been St. Thomas Aquinas and so responsible for the structure of the Catholic Church and the shape of Catholic theology, which was all well and good. So here you've got structure. Michael says, this is good, Rudolf. We need a bit of structure. And then he looks and he says, but there's a bit too much structure there. There's too much wordiness, Rudolf. You know, we could do it a little bit less head and a little bit more heart. Aristotle, you've done your job, it's fabulous, it's time for Plato. So the second part of the Michael School is what we might call the Plato half of the academy. And Plato was, of course, oh, you're going to like this one, Melody. I'm so sorry. The answer's just been given to me for one of those questions. Plato was the teacher of Aristotle. Now, Plato also incarnated in the first part of the 20th century. In fact, he incarnated almost the whole of the 20th century as Carl Jung. And I have to tell you that Carl Jung disliked Rudolf Steiner, and had Rudolf Steiner met Carl Jung, he would have returned the compliment. They just didn't get on, which just goes to show that great souls don't always have to be happy chappies. They can be real. And actually, that's the point here. Because what Jung, or what the Platonists would do, is start the Michael School in the physical world, and that was put into manifestation by the entity we know as Reverend Mario Schoonmaker. His teaching, what he called the Order of the Mystic Christ and the priesthood, these were expressions of the Michael teachings, and if you look carefully at what he put out there, you'll find that he taught about spiritual form creating physical reality. Now, I have this naughty communication from spirit, because Plato also had a teacher. And Plato's teacher was Socrates. Now, if you don't know who Socrates was, please go and look him up on Wikipedia or something. Socrates was the greatest of individuals. He didn't have a teacher. He learned it all for himself. He was very down to earth. He was very much about getting results, and he was so pushy with people, he was so got on their nerves, and he would do it really quite innocently. He'd say, what do you think about this, Clytemnestra? And Clytemnestra would say, blah, 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 and Socrates would say, well, that's really good, but you just said this, and that would mean this, and perhaps it would mean this, what do you think about this? And so he would actually destroy someone's mental structure because it was false. And that technique to this day is called the Socratic method, to deconstruct an inauthentic mental construct through examination, and especially self-examination. Now Socrates also has come into incarnation, and he's come into incarnation in the 21st century. Now it's really interesting, because Socrates had a wife. Socrates' wife was called Xanthippe, and Xanthippe was the archetypal shrew, not at all like my wife, who's incredibly loving and supportive and tells me every day she loves me. No, Xanthippe would never tell Socrates that she loved him. It's always, Socrates, why don't you wipe your feet on the doormat when you come in? Or Socrates, don't you put the lid down on the toilet when you finish peeing? She was very, very, well, I hope you've got the idea, she was not beating around the bush. Now, Socrates and Xanthippe were two halves of one soul. They were actually soulmates. So when they came back into incarnation, they came back as one individual, and it was such a crowd that it's a very special individual. It's a woman. It's a girl. Well, she's a woman now. And her name is Greta Thunberg. And I want you to consider how angry this little being has made the powers that be. How angry she's made them because she has dared to question the lie that they have created. The lies about our planet, the lies about power, the lies about the future. She's exposed them, she's exposed so many world leaders for self-serving, self-centered, narcissistic personalities who've created a world of lies, retreated into it, and pulled the lid shut. Oh, and talking about lies, let's talk about the leader of Russia for a moment. Oh, Ukraine. Someone's asked the question, I believe, who are the archangels of Russia and who are the archangels of Ukraine? Do we care what their names are? They are tied together. They are one and the same. And they should be united, but you cannot press unity upon a people. Now, there's an interesting situation here because, as someone said once, if you don't address the problems of history, you are condemned to repeat them. In the 20th century, after the groundwork laid by Rudolf Steiner and the Anthroposophical Society, despite the First World War, which almost stopped the whole movement, Rudolf Steiner dies about 1924, I think, and Christ comes into the etheric. And what that means is that now Christ could be perceived in his etheric form, and I haven't forgotten the images of the soul clad in light, and the etheric form of Christ is like light. And you might see Christ in the etheric, and it might appear to you as a form. He might come and show you the wounds in his hands, like he did to the disciples, the wound in his side. He might actually come and show you that. You might see him nailed to the cross. Or you might see him as motes of shining light in a cloud of light. You might experience Christ as the tears that pour from you when you consider and confront the misery and the suffering of the human condition. So Christ entered the etheric and could be seen by people who had developed their clairvoyance. But just because the powers of light do something doesn't mean that they can do it unopposed. Now, the woman in the picture from Revelation is not unopposed. She's not just having this wonderful spiritual experience. She's being attacked. She's being attacked by a dragon. And the dragon wants to seize the child, seize the individuality that's going to be born. Now, after Christ was born or incarnated into the etheric of the world, the negative spiritual forces, and in our teachings we name them variously, but one of the names we give them is Ahriman and the other is Lucifer, they coalesced, they came together, and they don't normally get along very well, but they came together and they were created out of the negative. They created out of the negative energies of the folk soul of Germany. They created an energy that overshadowed an entity that history knows as Adolf Hitler. Adolf wasn't some kind of wonderful great initiate who was full of black magic. No, he was the opposite. He was a weak, intellectually challenged individual who just happened to be immoral. He didn't have any moral boundaries, and he was open to be used as an instrument by these powers. I will say something about the two powers, just very, very briefly. Ahriman in Goethe's great play Faust is called Mephistopheles, and Mephistopheles announces himself as the spirit of negation. And if you read Mephistopheles' proclamation in Faust, you will see that he says, I deny everything. I deny that anything is good. I deny that there's any such thing as love. I deny that spirit exists. I deny that there's life after death. You can hear where I'm going with this. You can each of you immediately thought of where you'd heard this in your life. Lucifer. Now Lucifer, in the tradition, is guilty. Is not a denier. Lucifer loves being spiritual. He was having a ball being the most powerful angel until God created the human being and asked the angels to bow down before his latest creation. Of course, God wasn't saying man was superior. He just said, look guys, this is fresh out of the showrooms. I think you should show a little respect here. And all the angels bowed down except Lucifer, who was the greatest of all angels. So God said to Michael, just get rid of him, will you? So Michael has the job with his angels of kicking Lucifer out of heaven. And we see this story replayed in Revelation. But the sin of the characteristic of Lucifer is pride. Mm. So much pride that they cannot communicate any longer with someone else. They create what has become a byword. The narcissistic personality, which comes from the Greek myth where Narcissus was the most beautiful being, looked into the pond, which was the only way he could ever see himself, and fell in love with his own image. The gods eventually turned him into stone so he could have eternity gazing at himself. There's a motto from there too. But a narcissistic personality is one who can only see how great thou art, how great he is. Yeah. Thou being he, or perhaps she, and being unable to comprehend that another entity exists outside themselves. So for the real narcissistic personality, the world exists to fulfill their desires and their whims. It turns out that there is a greater amount of the Ahrimanic forces, I've got to get this right, in Hitler, and a smaller amount of Luciferic forces. But we got through that. We overcame the terrible negativity. We brought light back into the world. And Australia actually had a part to play in that, because here is where the School of Light was created, one of the great lights in the whole world. Now we've reached the 21st century. Christ is coming more and more into the etheric structure of the world. I don't know if you can quite grab that. Mm-hmm. But when you go out into the world of nature, you're in the etheric. Plants have a physical and they have an etheric. And if you spend time with plants, flowers, trees. If you spend time with that, you will feel the energy, their etheric energy, flowing in and inundating your own etheric. Mario used to say, get away by yourself and recharge from time to time. Go to the sea, go to the beach, another place which is full of etheric force. Now, the more the century advances, the more necessary it is that those of us who work for Christ be part of building the temple of the etheric. I put that wrongly. What we have to do is assist the spiritual forces, the spiritual energies, to build a sort of a structure. I'll call it a temple because that's the traditional word. We're going to build a temple in the etheric, and we've already started. And it's important for several reasons. First of all, because the new Christ energies are going to enter into the world in about 10 years' time through the new Christ bearer and those who will assist her in her work. And we need to change the etheric of the world to such an extent that that the Christ bearer will be able to do her work. And the second thing that has happened in the 21st century is an inpouring of the feminine, as Melody acknowledged and directed us towards in her prayer. And it's the feminine in the form of Mary began pouring into the world, particularly in 2010 and particularly in 2012. And in that time, since then, there's been the new birth of Christ, of the Christ energies. Now, what happens when Christ comes into the world? Reverend Murray used to have this old proverb, when Christ is at work, or when God is at work, the devil works overtime, and so it has proved. Just as the Ahriman and Lucifer joined together in the 21st century and overshadowed the being we know as Hitler and dragged the German people through the folk spirit of the German people into war and into dominance and control and tried to obliterate the Christ influence, the Christ energies. Christ is here to set us free. I've come to set men free, Jesus says in John. You can tell the difference between Christ and the devil because the devil wants to control you. Ahriman wants to control you. Lucifer wants to control you. Christ wants to set you free. So we have pouring into us in the early part of the 21st century this new Christ energy, this new energy of liberty, release, freedom of expression, creativity. And Ahriman and Lucifer say, nope, our turn now. So they find another person to overshadow. In this case, they can work with the negative forces emanating that are available to them from the group soul of Russia. And there are a lot more negative forces in Russia than there were in Germany. And may I say, here is one of the great paradoxes, that the most cultured countries, the countries with the greatest music, the greatest art, the greatest philosophy, they are the ones who are most at risk and most open to the forces of negativity. You can't have one without the other. And part of the reason of the amazing culture of Germany is that it represented the culture, the music, the art, it all came, even the philosophy, Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, Fichte, Kant, Hegel, they all came from a connection to the German folk soul. They're not intellects in that sense. They are expressions of the folk soul erupting into human consciousness. And Russia has got a stronger folk soul. The greatest composers of the 20th century, some of them, are Russian. Shostakovich, one of the greatest musical initiates of all time. Prokofiev, Tchaikovsky from the last century. Khachaturian. We could name dozens of great Russian composers and artists and musicians, and especially musicians. The greatest piano player of the 20th century was Russian, Vaclav Richter. Look at the culture. Look at the opportunity to exploit the soul that is given to the negative forces. So Ahriman and Lucifer have come together again, and they have overshadowed again another political leader. And Mr. Putin is like Hitler. He's not a strong personality. He masquerades. He cannot form a relationship with a woman. He uses female techniques. He poisons. Someone said to me the other day, John Pattinson reminded me that actually poison is traditionally a woman's weapon, but it's become the weapon of choice for Mr. Putin. And he has that because he's overshadowed by the same forces that worked through Catherine the Great, who also poisoned people she didn't get along with. So Ukraine. We haven't got a world war yet. We haven't dragged in all the other countries, but of course we have a world war by proxy. The West is delivering support to Ukraine. The East is delivering support to Russia. And it's become a competition, a contest, a conflict, a tussle, a tournament, if you like, not between European countries, which is the way World War II started out. It's a conflict and a wrestling match between East and West. And if you look at the East, Eastern countries who are supporting the conflict on the Russian side, you'll find they are totalitarian. Russia, North Korea, Iran. They are those who represent control. They are obviously not representing Christ. And the West, with all the Western faults, the West still represents freedom. It's tearing itself apart, but were it not for the Russian invasion of Ukraine, America would have capitulated and gone down into ruin and decay, because they would have not elected the current president, they would have elected the other president. He would have got away with it, and he would have dragged the US into a very, very dark, divisive place. And the Brotherhood has quite a few weapons at their disposal. They decided to send a little virus called COVID-19 just to spice things up as well, so that we couldn't get too carried away with ourselves and our brilliant achievements, and it reminded us of what's real. Now, what Revelation is about is being daring. It's about being daring to reveal ourselves. We can't reveal anyone else. We can't go around saying, oh, you're this or you're that. And even if you go to Martin for a tarot reading, or come to me for a spiritual reading, or go to someone else, we cannot reveal anything to you without the permission of your soul. And we can be mirrors to the soul. We can reflect what your soul wants to express. And in that way we can assist, but we cannot of our own accord go to someone and suddenly make pronouncements about them and say, oh, do an analysis or do a reading. If you're filled with Ahriman or Lucifer, of course you'd do that, and there's lots of people wandering around quite happy to do that. But not Christ. If you're filled with Christ, freedom is paramount to you. Your freedom and the freedom of every soul that you encounter. There is a fifth image. And the fifth image is a woman clothed in scarlet. And the book of Revelation calls this Babylon. And the picture of this woman clothed in scarlet is our soul. Our soul has become polluted over thousands and thousands of lives and thousands of incarnations. Our soul has become impure. It's become permeated with energies that want to barter and bargain. And the Babylon is all about buying and selling. So it indicates that the soul has become transactional. And what's worse, the soul, and here's the sixth image, rises upon a beast, rides upon a beast with seven horns and 10 heads. And as I, just in case you wonder how you can have 10 horns, they are distributed along the spine of the beast, by the way. They're not, never mind. But the soul, which has become, which has fallen from its pristine spiritual beauty, which has confused love with transaction, which has confused purpose with self-gratification, which has confused life with acquisition, that's the woman who rides the beast. And the beast is the energy that feeds the lie. Because what we have done, what our souls have done, and what has happened in the world is that our souls have believed the lie. And we have taken part in the lie. And it's so easy. It's so easy to take part in the lie. It starts off with the smallest lie. And it begins with a bigger lie. And then a bigger lie. And then in the end, we don't know this, but we're lying to ourselves. We have created a self and a life that is false, empty, and it's a shell. Just on the lie, so you can see how it works. When Mr. Putin decided to invade Ukraine, he lined up all his troops on the border, and he said, no, we're not going to invade you. First lie. Then he sent his troops over the border. And he said to his troops, don't worry about it. There'll be no fighting. There will be there'll be parades and flags. And the Ukrainians are going to turn out and cheer you as you take your tanks along the highways and the byways and through the main streets of Kiev and Mariupol and all the other cities. And that was a lie. That was a bigger lie. Because his troops believed him. They believed that they were going to a place where they would be welcomed and they were doing something noble. And the lies went on and on. Instead of being a liberation army, the army became a cohort of war criminals. And there are terrible, terrible truths that will come to light over the next year. I know you all want to know when's it going to stop. No time soon, I'm sorry. There is still purpose for this conflict. And the best that we can do as spiritual beings is to hold all those souls passed over, and in my vision this evening, there were Ukrainians standing next door to Russians, and they were standing next door to Australians. Don't ask me why there are Australians there. Dutch, Swedes, Brits, they're all there. They've all gone for this cause. But the ones who went there for the cause of freedom, they're the ones whose candles shine brightest. And this is how spirit works. Many of the Russian soldiers who were lied to and deceived and died in fear and panic and terror, their candles went out. But they were relit. And they were relit by their brothers and sisters, the Ukrainians, the British, all the people who were fighting the opposite side. These are the ones who lit the candles of the soldiers of the other army. And when I saw them in the vision, they are all together, they are all intermingled. There is no enmity in spirit. And because the souls have been given that grace, and the grace through the prayers of so many, they have been able to move into the light. And it's always the feminine that opens the door to light. Women tend to be much more wedded to the truth than men. The male consciousness, because of its need to create dominance, tends to have a much stronger ego and tends to be more prone to narcissism, tends to be more prone to create lies to promote their own place and status in the world. That's why I say tends. Obviously, this is not a mathematical equation. But as we move into the 21st century, the leaders will more and more be women. And I mean by this not just political leaders, although some of them will be women as well, but the moral leaders, the spiritual leaders. How few spiritual leaders can you think of? How many spiritual leaders can you think of who are women? There aren't many in Hinduism, there's not many in Christianity, there's not many in Buddhism. All the established, I don't think there are very many in Islam, there's not many in Judaism. The women as spiritual leaders have been pushed into a corner, but over the next 20, 30 years, there will be a great outpouring of spirituality through female figures, through women figures. And coming to the end now, I'm being shown the very last image, and it's the image of the heavenly city descending. And I'm being told that this is in the future. This should happen for us through the descent, the descent of spirit, which is the new consciousness of the individual. The new Christ consciousness is programmed, so to speak. It's timed to be in the last 10 years of the 21st century, that there will be a great outpouring of consciousness into humanity. And it's at that stage that humanity will split almost overnight. It'll split into those who experience the new consciousness and will move forward spiritually, and the other side of the split will those who have darkened their minds and their souls and their feelings to such an extent that they refuse the light. Now, light has to have permission to enter. If you say no thanks, don't want your light, go away, light will go away. You've got to open the doors. That's the symbolism of the feminine, opening the doors. The feminine is always the soul. We have to learn to allow our soul to open the doors to light, to flood into our consciousness. Now, there is a lot to happen between 2023 and 2090. And the fate of humanity is in the balance. Don't take it that we will be business as usual next time you come into incarnation. Humanity, through the masculine, dominant, destructive, sabotaging, there's another word that I should have there, it's not given to me, which is probably just as well. Through that consciousness, that destructive consciousness of the environment, has brought us to the brink where we are on the verge of our own extinction. And I'm asking, is it too late? And the answer I'm getting is sort of like a shrug of the shoulders. Well, yes, the way you're going, it's too late. Oh, but there's always hope. Thanks very much, Spirit. It's good to know that there's always hope. But there has to be a change. But Spirit says, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it, guys. We've got this handled. If you won't do something about the destruction of the climate, we'll just let it happen. You can destroy yourselves. You don't need 8 billion of you in the world. It's far too many anyway. About 100,000 would work. 150,000, that's the perfect number according to Revelation. And if we destroy our climate to such an extent, we will not be able to incarnate anymore. There will be certain regions of the world that will be able to come into incarnation. Southern Victoria is one of them, which is why there's so many Melchizedeks here. New Zealand is another of them, by the way. That's why Spirit is working powerfully in New Zealand. But there is a veil drawn over that period between now and 2050. 2050 will be the time when we will know whether we've gone too far. And in 2050 we will panic, we will bring things to an end, we will take action, but it will be too late. But the action that we take will be sufficient to retain enough of the planet's surface so that human souls can continue to incarnate and over the next 1,000 years heal the earth, so that after the 21st century on this plan, the next 1,000 years would be an era of healing. We would have learned a lesson. Now that's plan B. Plan A is still in place. Plan A says, oh, we could cut carbon emissions. Yes, we can sign agreements. We could stop cutting down forests and jungles. We could stop it. We could do something about it. The question is, will we do something about it? And because Christ gives us freedom, we have the freedom as human beings coming into incarnation to say, yes, we will stop the destruction of our planet, or no, we'll just keep going the way we're going, and we'll every man and every woman for themselves, and we just want to be comfortable. If I have to not drive my car, that makes me feel uncomfortable, so no, I'd rather drive my car and buy more petrol. And sorry, that is a silly example, but
catch the bus.
Yes. We can, and many of us are making choices right now, and we say, it's only me, I'm one person, I might be an elderly 70-year-old, talking about myself here obviously, and what can I do? But I will do what I can do. And when I come back into incarnation, if I've tried really hard to do everything I can do to help the planet, even growing a few flowers or having a garden will help the planet, even something as simple as that. If I can do what I've done, then I will be in a position to assist in the healing and the renovation of the planet in the next 1,000 years. So we've come to the end of the revelation. Each of these 7 revelations will be unpacked for us, within us, for ourselves, in the year to come, and each of us will discover the meaning of the spiral. We'll discover the meaning of the book with the seven seals. We'll discover the meaning of the being on the throne and the 24 elders worshipping that being. We'll see certain changes happening within our physical bodies. Mind you, changes are going to happen whether we do spiritual exercises or not. Just if you do spiritual exercises, the changes tend to be nicer. More upbuilding. Even if your body is falling apart, at least you can enjoy the process. Scarlet Woman, the woman seated on the beast, and the descent of the New Jerusalem into consciousness. These will be unpacked for us month by month, week by week, day by day, until, if we've followed the path of revelation and allowed our consciousness, our thinking, to witness and observe the developments and the changes, if we can do that, we will have become the revelation ourselves. So far, we'll take some questions, maybe.
Just want to say thank you for answering the Greta Thunberg question, who she was, because she was, in my prayer, one of the Christed souls that were lifting us to higher ground. So the question that comes first is from Becky, and she says, Reverend Mario did a series of lectures on birth, death, and beyond. In one of those lectures, he stated that the child is connected to its mother's bodies until they are 28 years old, lessening at each seven-year cycle as they develop their own bodies. My question, therefore, is, number one, who is the child connected to if it has been given up for adoption? And number two, what happens if the mother dies before that child reaches 28?
Thank you, Becky. Well, if a child is given up for adoption, it's gone to the wrong parent in the first place very often. So that if mother gives birth and circumstances or desire moves the mother to place the child for adoption, perhaps the mother dies, then the sole parents will be the parent, the adoptive parent, that the child goes to. It's a sort of simple thing. Sometimes our biological parents bring us into the world, and we get from them, of course, the physical body, which is important for the first 7 years. So we do get the genetics, but the etheric, the astral, and the soul body, if you could call them that, that will come from the adoptive parents. And if the child is not adopted, for example, if they are thrown into a foster home where there is no parent, or an orphanage, as used to happen, then they will never integrate in the first 28 years. They will never become a person, an individuality within their own rights, with any great ease. They will not be able to integrate their memory. They won't know who they are. They won't be able to develop a sense of identity. They won't know how to respond emotionally to other people, and so on. But this doesn't happen very often, fortunately. If the second case is if the mother dies before the age of 28, well, depends then. If the child is with the father, the child, let's say the mother dies when the child is 14, so the child's got the mother's etheric. If the child is loses the mother at the age of 28, sorry, at the age of 14, and the mother doesn't have to die, there could be a divorce and the child could go with the father. Well, then the child would get the father's astral, because the astral builds between 14 and 21. Now, there's an interesting thing that happens between 21 and 30, which is where the individuality parks itself, so to speak. It's we start to develop the soul body, or the mental body, as some people call it, at the age of 21. It's not etheric, it's not astral, it's not physical. Mother's already given those. So where is the child going to get its individuality from its mother? No, of course not. You can't. A child that would get its individuality from its mother would never become an individual in its own right. It's hard enough for a child to break away from its mother, as it is. As Jesus says, when you're young, the man cleaves to his mother, and then he marries and he cleaves to his wife. So he has to leave the mother and start gaining the astral of his wife. That's in the biblical sense. So that's all very well. If the child gets married, they'll have the spouse to share etherics and build their etheric and astral with. But where the I am, or the first spark of individuality, which comes in at 21, and by that I mean that age is when the person turns around and recognizes that they are an individual. They're not just a child, they're not just someone's daughter, not just someone's son. They are a person in their own right. Well, that one comes from the grandparents. So the grandparents have the greatest effect on the child building their identity as their own identity in those 7 years between the age of 21 and 28. So if the mother dies at the age of 21, no problem, Spirit says. Grandparents can take care of it, and that's why often when mother dies, children do go to their grandparents, because the grandparents can give them that individuality. And it's also one reason why grandparents often get along with the children better than the parents do, because they're not sharing astrals. It's when you share an astral, like mother, father, child, that's when you get fights and conflicts, because the astral gets emotional and reactive. But no sharing of astrals with grandparents, they're far too old anyway. There's no ability there. But by the time you get older, into your 60s and 70s, you have developed an individuality. And that older person can mirror back individuality into the grandchild. And that's why a lot of grandchildren have great relationships with their grandparents, because they're learning to become individuals through them.
Okay, the next question, thank you for that wonderful answer. The next question comes from Pauline, and she says, my question arises in reaction to the public and abrasive expression of some women in recent times, e.g. Greta Thunberg, Grace Tame, Meghan Markle, to what they perceive as injustices, abuse, and neglect. The question, therefore, is how can the feminine impulse be effectively expressed in the world at the moment, and does the means of expression justify the wished outcome? Is there a more enlightened way to effect change?
Answer is in one word, Pauline.
Yes.
Scream! Yell! Make a noise!
That's Grace Tame.
Who finds Greta Thunberg abrasive? I'll tell you who finds Greta Thunberg abrasive. Donald Trump finds Greta Thunberg abrasive. People who are male,
white,
and white, by and large, find Greta Thunberg very abrasive. People who are in control and in power find Greta Thunberg abrasive. Interestingly enough, young people who are deeply concerned with the future of their planet and the inheritance that we are receiving from, or they are receiving from their elders, which is us, they don't find Greta Thunberg abrasive at all. So that's an excellent question, because it explains so much. Let's look at Meghan Markle. Who finds Meghan Markle abrasive? I'll tell you who finds Meghan Markle abrasive. white people who don't like an uppity coloured person coming in and polluting the bloodstream of their white royal highnesses. I was going to say something very rude there. But Spirit says, now, now, John, we're still here. No swearing while we're around. The funny thing is that coloured women don't find Meghan Markle abrasive. When Meghan Markle went to South Africa and talked to crowds and crowds of women about their ambitions and their desires in life, they didn't find Meghan Markle abrasive. Who does find Meghan Markle abrasive? People who want to control, direct, and put other people in their place. They find Meghan Markle abrasive. Who finds Grace Tame abrasive? Well, I tell you, who doesn't find Grace Tame abrasive? People who've been victims of sexual assault. They don't find Grace Tame abrasive. People who've been put through the trauma of trials, of people controlling them through abuse, using sexual abuse as a means of control, who've had to go and try and fight against an abuser. These people do not find Grace Tame abrasive. Who finds Grace Tame abrasive? Well, actually, anyone who watched television and saw a particular Australian Prime Minister react or find it so difficult to know how to react to a powerful feminine figure would understand what sort of consciousness finds Grace Tame abrasive. And it's not a consciousness that one would call spiritual. It is a consciousness of judgment. It's a consciousness of evaluation. So as long as we take on a consciousness of judgment, we will find, because of our judgments and the framework it places us in, we will find Greta Thunberg, Meghan Markle, Grace Tame abrasive. How should the feminine express itself? Well, I hope you've followed, all of you, the fact this is the year of revelation. And in the year of revelation, the soul is bringing the Christ to birth. And what happens in birth? Is birth a really lovely thing where someone gives you a pansy and out pops a new baby? Is it a stork deliver you? A little cherub with wings floating down from the heavens. Well, I'm not sure. Being a man, I actually can't speak from, at least in this incarnation, I can't speak from personal experience. But my understanding is that birth can be very painful, and very often the woman yells out at the top of her voice because it's the best thing that she can do. Why keep all that pain in? It's when you release it, when you release the stress, that then the baby is freed to come out. So yes, the feminine should yell, should be strident, should have a voice. Do you know that in ancient times the men did not speak? They were put in the corner, in the temples, in the oracles. The oracles were all women. The men would go to the oracles, present the questions, sit down and shut up. Rightly so.
Oh, it's happening again, isn't it? Sorry.
So, and in Egypt, the priestesses were a power to be reckoned with. The ancient myths have us being created, not by men, but out of women. Sometimes the men's there to give a bit of a helping hand, but mainly the woman gets the credit. So the feminine in the future is going to be vocal. The reason that the female, the feminine, has been thought that you should be a good girl, sit in the corner, be silent, shut up, don't interrupt your betters, is because that's the way the males wanted it. It was a control mechanism. There's another strong female figure who words just float into my thoughts. Jacinda Ardern. her words, when she was asked how feminine leadership expresses itself, she says, be kind, be strong. Now, being kind doesn't mean that you're a wimp. Being kind doesn't mean that you are a pushover. Being kind doesn't mean, as in the Ukraine, that you throw down your weapons and rush out to meet the invading soldiers with flowers. No. Because along with being kind, that wouldn't be being kind to any of those people, because it would be creating a monster within their own consciousness. If you were kind towards cruelty, you encourage cruelty. If you were kind towards evil, you grow evil. Let us not be kind when we're kind. Let us remember that we also have to be strong. Jacinda Ardern was not kind to the person who massacred 51 people in Christchurch, but she was strong. She said, I will never speak that person's name aloud again. And what a power that was. That's the strength. And the feminine strength is the strength to open up, to listen. How hard is it for us to listen? It's very hard for men to listen. We're all the time thinking, making judgments. That's why the abrasive consciousness or the abrasive reaction comes mainly from men. It's a male thing, because men are not listening to what's being said. They are busy making judgments and thinking about what clever thing they'll say in reply, what nice little put down they can come up with, what derogatory statement, what nasty little comment they can get their trolls to post on Instagram or Facebook. But so strength is needed to cope with that. It's going to be more and more that we will see women standing up and being very strong and saying, enough is enough. There is an old Latin proverb, non consentio, I do not give my consent. And the female voice is the one that can say, I do not give my consent to war. I do not give my consent to deceit. I do not give my consent to hate. I do not give my consent to corruption. I do not give my consent to self-centeredness and narcissistic personalities. I give my consent to life, to light, to love. And I think that is where we will hear the female voice coming. And I can tell you that if Plan B for the future of the Earth comes into operation, and the masculine consciousness succeeds in its efforts to destroy our environment and our planet, then the leaders who will pick up the threads will be the women. But hopefully that will never happen. Or even if it does happen, it's a long way in the future.
Okay, this question...
Oh, I've got one other thing to say.
Ooh.
I just had another thing.
Quickly.
Meghan Markle and Prince Harry. I know who they were too. I've been told who they were. Don't laugh at this one. They were Anthony and Cleopatra. And if you know the story, Anthony was a general. Okay, that's Harry. And he fell in love with Cleopatra, who was the queen. In this way, it's sort of the other way around. Cleopatra marries Anthony and makes him royal. In this incarnation, of course, it goes the other way around. Harry marries Meghan and makes her royal. But you can see the power, the rulership, and the charisma that is in that soul. And Spirit has something interesting to say about the royal family too. Oh, this will never reach the ears of King Charles, so why don't I say it? The royal family is a fossil. It doesn't need to exist. We don't need kings and queens anymore. It could work as a very good head of state mechanism, but it was scheduled to be thrown out in the 20th century. What saved it was the incarnation of an exceptional soul who became known as Elizabeth II, who demonstrated the incredible strength that the feminine can have. And you might say, well, she didn't stand up and kneel. Yes, she did. She made very strong statements all throughout her life, often by saying, I won't interfere, or by saying certain things to certain people in just the right way. She used her voice. She was not allowed to use it in public, but my goodness, did she have a voice and did she use it. So that it was put on hold, and the spirit said, well, this feminine thing is working quite well. Let's send another great female soul, someone who'll be charismatic and attract millions of people and take the royal family to not only take them to a new level of popularity, but make them better looking too. Let's put some decent genes into that not very good looking Windsor gene pool. So they sent Diana. We know what happened there. The royal family basically destroyed Diana. We won't go into that, but they rejected her. But spirit gives two chances. So the second chance was they said, we will send another charismatic female figure, because the only way that transformation can happen is through a charismatic female figure who's not afraid to speak, who's not afraid to have a voice, and who can, through their influence and their energy, transform the fossilized structures of royalty, of the monarchy. So that's number two. Yes.
You didn't say her name.
Oh, well, number two is obviously Meghan.
Yeah. Harry's pretty charismatic too.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, absolutely.
And have you finished that one?
I have.
Oh, gorgeous. Thank you. I think this has been completely answered, but I'll ask you anyway. It's from Sharon. Could you provide us with further information about the transformation in human consciousness being enacted in the ongoing Ukraine-Russian conflict? Also, these are three questions in one. Also, how can we, as Melchizedek priests, lend assistance to this process? And lastly, but not least, the niggly bit, which archangels? You've already answered that. Okay, go for it.
I think that we have discussed the Ukraine-Russian situation. The archangels of Ukraine, or the angels of Ukraine, Russia, like brothers, they are connected. And at present they are tied together, they're connected back to back, so that the Archangel of Ukraine is facing one way and the Archangel of Russia is facing the other. They're not able to look at each other. And the Archangel of Russia has been bound. The Archangel of Russia has been bound in colours of sombre blue blacks. And so it's not free, it's struggling to become free, but it's been bound. Now the Archangel of Ukraine is very colourful. It has rainbow wings. It has rainbows through its wings. It has beautiful beautiful golden hair. It's wearing wonderful diaphanous robes. It looks like an angel who knows how to have a good time. And what we're seeing is that they are two halves of the same race. Russia and Ukraine should be united, but they were united. They were united in spirit until the head of Russia decided that they should be united physically, following a dream which was given to him by the negative powers of a greater Russian empire. There should be a greater Russian empire. There should be a huge Russian enlightened consciousness within the world. And we've said that there is a need for prayer and love directed towards Ukraine and towards Russia. And it will work its way through. I don't see, well, I'm not being given any time in sight, and I think we'd all, I'm speaking for myself here, perhaps many of us would like it to come to a sudden end with the sad demise of Mr. Putin from something or other, but I don't think that's quite on the cards. The Archangel's name, the Archangel of Russia, is named Sohrab, spelt Grace, S-O-H-R-A-B, and the Archangel of Ukraine is named Zadkiel, which is also the name of the Archangel of Jupiter, by the way. So that that's why Ukrainians have a more expansive consciousness than the Russians, because Sohrab is connected with Saturn, so they are a more constraining and controlling influence. And there's a deep sadness in the Russian soul, which is also in the Ukrainian soul, but not to the same extent. So the song that began the evening for us is the sadness of the Slavic soul, which is weighed down by a consciousness of being very old and having so many incarnations and experiencing and remembering in the soul so much pain and suffering.
Oh, sitting down. Why am I saying that? Okay, this one is from Grace. It's the last question. Would you please be able to give us an update on how the building of the temple in Christ Church is going from a bird's eye, even higher spiritual, of course it'll be the highest spiritual perspective. From a spiritual perspective, I never wonder what I'm doing here, but it's hard work on the ground, so an update would be very much appreciated.
What can I say, Grace? Not a sparrow falls, but God is aware of it. So if he has his eyes on the sparrow, and he's got his eyes very much on Christchurch as well. The thing is that none of us are great initiates. The great initiates are all off doing great things.
Mm.
We are the support act, like the supporting cast. And the main players have left the stage in our case, but the support carries on. And you know, in Greek theatre, the most important statements were not made by the protagonists, but by the chorus, which stood in the side and made snarky comments about what was going on from, as you call it, a bird's eye perspective. So we get to comment from perhaps not from above, but at least from the side of the stage. The temple, and I've tried to describe this in the reading this year, is a temple of consciousness. It doesn't have a space. Okay, it's not something that's in Christchurch per se. That's where the Christ bearer is. But it's not something that's in Christchurch per se. But it has layers, levels. It's like an Egyptian temple. It goes from the outside to the inside. Now the outside is indeed the physical situation that the Christ bearer is born into, a particular country, a nationality, a consciousness, and a language. So that's okay, that's being taken care of. Then there is the astral level. Now what it's like going to the temple, you go into the first courtyard, and there you are in the astral level, which is the level of animals, the level of thinking actually. And here we need people like the psychologists, and the psychiatrist and the therapist, all the people who work with words and conversation, we need them to have conversations. We need them to have great, positive, soul-releasing conversations. We don't need them to have deep esoteric knowledge. That's not necessary. We need a group of people to have conversations. And that's what our psychologists are really good at. And that's probably where they would find themselves comfortable, in the the second courtyard. Now, then you go into the third courtyard, and the courtyards all get smaller and smaller because you're getting closer and closer to the Holy of Holies. Now, the third courtyard is where the beautiful trees grow and the flowers, because it's the etheric. And this is very important at this point in time, that because, as I've indicated in the reading, we are building within the world the etheric temple for Christ. So therefore, the role of building the etheric, this inner courtyard for the Christ bearer, the temple that surround her work, is very important also. Now here we don't need people who are clever. Here we need people who are willing to have their hearts open, who are willing to be made fools of if necessary, who are willing to look stupid and not clever in the face of the world, who are willing to love, who are willing to pray in perhaps a very simple devotion, who are willing to pray every day to Christ or to God, who are willing to do a rosary every day or something like that. Simple devotion, constant practice, that's what will build the etheric. And the teachings for that are given for those who have ears, so to speak. There's the final, the very final core, and that's the physical body. Not the physical environment, it's the outer core, the physical body. But the physical body here, the temple, comprises the individual who is the Christ bearer and her parents, her family, and her extended family. Now, this is, in our understanding, it's at the inner core of the temple that the God always appears. And it's manifested through the energies that flow through these people. And they are all ordinary people. They're teachers, they're motor mechanics, one of them works for Telstra. The kids love soccer. They like to do cooking. The Christ bearer likes to sew. Well, that's not surprising because she was an individual, great individual in another life, which we won't go into, who always got her nuns to come round and sew with her. So the family is the absolute jewel here. And what we must be able to do is leave the family alone. Tempting as it is to introduce ourselves and say, knock on the door and say, "Hi, I just want to let you know I'm praying for the Christ bearer who's your daughter, or for her companion who's your son." We really don't need to put this pressure on the family or on the child. So she's being brought up in a very ordinary, very loving, very together family, and she's being surrounded by this love, guidance and structure, so that she will have all those bodies that Becky talked about. She's been given a beautiful physical body. She's been given the etheric, which means that the memories are starting to emerge in her, and we understand this from what we hear. And she's going to be given an astral body which will produce a very keen thinking mind, and there are already signs of this. And her grandparents, and possibly her grand uncles, aunts, they are going to be there to help with the development of the individuality. So we're all foot soldiers, Grace. There are no generals here. And each little bit that we do, each little bit is like the angels come along behind us and pick up gold nuggets from our little endeavours. The angels like to take these gold nuggets and stick them in a bank called the Bank of Gold Nuggets, the Heavenly Bank of Gold Nuggets, I'm sorry, I stand corrected. And one day, when you pass on, the angel will meet you at the gate when you enter into the spiritual worlds, and you'll say, "Oh, I'm in this beautiful place, and I've got, look at all these shops. I've always wanted to go shopping in heaven, but I've got no money." And the angel says, "Nope, here you are," takes you to the Heavenly Bank of Gold Nuggets, pulls out what all the gold nuggets that you've spent, and says, "Go and have a spending spree, Grace." So may it be for all of us. So shall it be.
So shall it be.